The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. Today is Monday, February 4th, just checking on the date, 2013. And we only have one bill on the agenda, Senator Rest, Senate Bill 86. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an author's amendment. It's the A2.
You have copies?
I do not.
Oh, okay.
Did we not get copies to you? We're going to need some copies.
I saw you.
Sorry, Carmen.
It's a very technical amendment.
Because we knew there were supposed to be copies.
Recommended by council and agreed to by council for the Board of Accountants.
We don't have copies of that amendment. We're getting them printed. So maybe you want to start.
I can tell you what it is, and then you'll get the written.
Okay.
It's on page 7.7, and page 7, line 7, and simply changes must comply with the word complies, and that gets to the that meets the technical requirements that we need in that section.
You delete must?
Delete must comply and insert complies.
Okay.
And you'll have that in a written form.
Okay. And that's all the amendment does?
That's all it does.
Okay.
So I can move that if you want, but you'll have it in written form for your clerk.
Okay. Does anybody want to move it? Do you want to move it, Senator Hall?
Sure. I'll
okay.
Move it.
Senator Hall moves the amendment 7.7, delete must comply and insert complies. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senate Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 86 is a bill that deals with the operations of the Board of Accountancy, the practice of certified public accountants, and gets rid of some obsolete language that is no longer necessary from provisions that apply to applications for licenses prior to 2006. And so I'll just take you briefly through the bill. In Section 1, it changes the licenses and certificates from being issued every 3 years to an annual issuance. Right now, there's a three-year period for the license, but CPAs have to annually report their continuing professional education hours. And what the Board of Accountancy and the Society has found is that there is there's been some disconnect between that, because and people have inadvertently been found in not in compliance with the rules in the statute. And so to remedy that, we're going to an annual license, and the CPE that has to be reported within that same period. So it will be an annual calendar year license and a calendar year reporting of the continuing professional education. So that's what's in line Section 1 and at line 111. And, again, these provisions are supported by both the practitioners as well as the Board of Accountancy. And
thank you.
Section and it starts next year, January 1st, if you look at lines 2, 4. It starts January 1st, clean slate for licenses that are renewed on and after that date. In Section 2, it gets rid of some obsolete references to licenses and provisions before 2006. Those provisions were changed in 2008, and so this is obsolete language. In Section 3, this is clarifies that everything is that the CPE must be earned by December 31st of each year and reported in that same year. In Section 4 is moving from the rules to the to the statutes, the fee structure that is overseen by the Board of Accountancy, and providing or proposing there be changes in four of those areas. And they are, if you'll just look at the numbered ones under paragraph B there rather than at the lines on the bill, they are the first one, which moves the initial issuance of a certificate to $150 from $50. Renewal of a certificate with an active status to $100 a year, up from $45. Number 11, which is at line 3.33, the initial registered accounting practitioner firm permits to $100 from $45, and number 16, the renewal of certificates with an inactive status to $25 per year, up from $15 a year. These are not new. It looks like new language, but this is language that's been in the in Minnesota rules, and the Board of Accountancy and the State Society are now moving that they are now proposing that they be moved into the statute. Keeping in mind, usually we like things in the rules because there can be fluctuations, and you don't have to come back and make, you know, every couple of years make proposed big changes. Well, these fees haven't been changed in 30 years, so we think we're not doing, and we're not a very aggressive radical group here, and so we think that a 30-year statute or rules can be with great confidence be moved into the statute. Why are they proposing this? Well, there will be a separate bill before the State Department's Finance Division for a budget request for an appropriation that will deal with these fees, but that's no guarantee. We like to think that when we have fees that what they do is serve the purpose for which they are collected. But we also know that there are fees imposed where since they go into the general fund budget, they don't always go back to servicing the purpose for which they were collected. And in fiscal year 11, under the prior fee structure, there were $794,000 collected under that statute, under that provision, but the Board of Accountancy was only allocated $505,000. In FY12, they got $480,000 out of an appropriation or out of the fees raised of $940,000. So those dollars were kept for the general fund. They are going to be recommending an additional two FDEs, one to pay for an investigator with regard to compliance issues within the CPA profession, and also doing some updating with regard to the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy's database, which will give them much more accurate information and sharing of information. In Section 5, it's additionally taking out some obsolete language that refers to provisions before 2006. In Section 6, and that's the, if you turn over to page 7, paragraph 2, this is a, that's what we just amended, changing must comply to complies, and I think there's agreement that technically that works better within the context of this paragraph, and it is updating the way in which firms can refer to themselves in terms of their names. In 2001, Minnesota adopted the Uniform Accounting Act, Accountancy Act, and what this really does in effect is just to update the statute. And the reason why that's important is prior to that time, there were some issues with being able to have your license issued in one state and be able to practice in another. And the Uniform Accountancy Act, the impact of it was if you're properly licensed in your state, that gives you certain mobility to practice in other states without getting a separate license. And that now is 50 states across the board. So this is an updating to that with regard to changes that have been made in the Uniform Accountancy Act. And then at the end, there are repealers, and they were not attached to the end of the bill, which they should have been, in my mind. But anyway, what they do is to repeal those sections that deal with those obsolete provisions and then repeal the rules because with regard to the fee structure because they're being moved into the statute. So, Madam Chair and members, that is this bill, and we have representatives both from the State Board of Accountancy and the CPA Society in support of the bill, and I know of no opposition.
And thank you, Senator Rest. And members, if anyone wants to see that statutory language, we do have the statute book here that's being repealed, in case you want to check up on our staff. And I told Ms. James that we should be sure we copy that in the future.
I did copy it if members want to see what it is. But it's I
copy
assure
it
you
and
that
attach it.
My representation of it is accurate.
All right. Any questions on the bill? Yes, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rust, what's going to guarantee that we collect that differentiation between what the accountant board's got and what there's a big gap, seems like?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, unfortunately, when the way in which that that process works is that all fees are collected and deposited in the general fund. And we've seen time and time again that when there are budget issues, they will tell the agencies, well, you'll just have to do with less. We've seen it happen with the airports fund. We've seen it happen with the fire service fund. And the Board of Accountancy is unfortunately is no different. And I think if we looked at a number of other areas that we would find the same practice, that the dollars that are raised don't always go back into serving the particular purpose. There is a surcharge on marriage licenses to deal with domestic violence, for example. And it's hard to claim that the fee on a marriage license is, if we only had it servicing the actual cost of producing a marriage license, that that fee would be appropriate. So it's not without precedent, but I just wanted folks to know what the level has been with regard to recovery to operate the Board of Accountancy from the fees that are collected. And again, these have not changed in 30 years, none of them that are there except the four that we're now proposing. As a retired CPA, I wouldn't object to there being an increase, particularly in the CPA. I mean, that's the one I know the most, from $45 to $100, if it meant that additional funds in terms of recovery of that could go to the Board of Accountancy for compliance, for investigating allegations of misconduct, and the database that NAVSBA is proposing or has allows better access by the public to those dispositions by the Board of Accountancy when there has been some sort of misconduct on the part of its members.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair. Senator Rest, going from a period of not more than 3 years to an annual at the beginning of that, this is, I mean, the board's pushing that and...
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, the board and the CPA Society thinks that it's a better matchup than having, a three-year license and then you have to report to CPE annually, and people were getting out of compliance and getting negative reactions by the Board of Accountancy because inadvertently they weren't reporting it within the time period they should. And we can have them talk about some examples of that. But by having the license period and the CPE reported within the 12 months, so it has to be reported within by December 31st, there should be no confusion about what year you should report your CPE in to cover that licensing year. It was thought originally that by having a three-year period, it would, streamline things. You wouldn't have to do it every year, but it's turned out to be a nuisance and inconvenience, and for some practitioners, a nightmare.
Hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair, would you like to hear from the board?
Yes, let's hear from your testifiers.
Or the CPA Society.
Welcome to the committee, and just state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Sharon Jensen. I'm a member of the Board of Accountancy, and I really don't have a whole lot. Ann did an excellent job of covering what's in the bill. If you have further questions of us, we're happy to try and help Ann field those. So,
okay. Thanks. And...
Madam Chair, yes. Members of the committee, I'm Doreen Frost. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Accountancy, and I'm here to sit for questions as well and would be happy to answer any of them.
Okay. Are there any other questions, then? All right. Senator Rest, would anyone like to make the motion? Senator Eaton. Want me to state the motion for you?
Please.
It has to be – it's passed as amended and we refer to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. I would like to move that we... Senate file number 86, as amended, be passed and moved to the
Commerce
Committee.
Okay, Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 86 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Senate Commerce Committee. Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
On your way. Okay, the rest of today we had some overviews that got rescheduled for whatever reason. And so we'd like to invite Pat Bourne from the Met Council. And if Judge Shetland is here as well, or he's presenting another committee, I don't know if he's back yet. And you have others joining you?
I do.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the Regional Administrator from the Metropolitan Council, and I'm joined by my colleagues who will introduce themselves. And you have a long list of folks who are going to present themselves to you today. So we are going to be going through our material quickly. Please stop us as you have questions. The regional administrator of the Metropolitan Council is like a city manager or a city administrator. We are a local unit of government. And the administrator plays that role that is similar to that of a city manager or a city administrator in other local units. Council has been around since 1967 and was formed during that time as a result of a number of concerns.
Mr. Bourne, do you want to introduce who's with you at the table?
Sure. Guy Peterson, the Director of Community Development. Mm-hmm. Lisa Thompson, the General Manager of our Environmental Services. Division, and Amy Venowitz from our Metropolitan Transportation Services Division, each of whom are going to talk about their work. But we have about 30 slides or so, right, and we'll try to get through them
Great, thank you.
Painlessly as we can, at least for us. Maybe it will not be painless for you. Although that's our objective, is to get questions answered and to give you a brief overview of what we do. But back in 1967, the world was a little different. We had a failing transit system that was privately owned. We had open space that was rapidly being developed. We had a wastewater system that was not well run, and run by many small units of government who were beginning to deal with significant environmental needs that were that they were having trouble facing. The general motivation behind the council when it was formed was to create a body that would collaborate with local units of government to do long-range planning and to have a long-range view. And so that became our initial role. That changed later, and we'll talk about things that were added as time went on, but that was our beginning. We are the council is composed of 17 members appointed by the governor, one of whom serves as the chair, Sue Haig, who's not able to be here today. Those 17 represent geographic districts of approximately equal population, 170,000 people apiece, more or less. The legislature and state law give us a variety of responsibilities, and we organize ourselves into three distinct groups of activities. And you're going to hear from each one of the leaders of those groups or leaders in those groups today. Community Development, Guy Peterson's organization, is responsible for grant making, regional planning, housing services, and other activities. The big work that Guy's folks do is underway now, which is to update our 10-year plan, or our 30-year plan. We do that every 10 years. We have called that plan Thrive MSP 2040. You'll be hearing more about that if you haven't. The Environmental Services Division, Lisa Thompson's organization, runs the wastewater treatment plants in the region. There are seven of them. That organization came to us in 1994 after having been subject to a big merger in the 1970s, and we'll tell you more about that. The Environmental Services Division also has some other responsibilities to monitor surface water, to do drinking water planning in the region, but their primary role is to operate and plan the wastewater treatment services. And finally, transportation, which is our largest two organization, Metro Transit and Metropolitan Transit Services, is involved in both operating the transit service or most transit services in the region, as well as planning, so planning for both highways and transit in the seven-county region.
We have some in, too.
We are, as a result of our planning work, we are the demographer for the region, and our regional forecast has been published last year. We are forecasting over the next 30 years a 900,000 increase in population, a 37% increase in employment, and we think that about 62% of households in 30 years are not going to have kids. That's a big change from today. Another big change from today is that we expect that about 43% of the people who live in this region are not going to be white. And finally, a doubling of the senior population. Those are trends that have been underway for some time. They're based on birth rates. They're based on other trends that are going on throughout Minnesota. This region is certainly a reflective of other trends that are taking place not only around the country, but all over Minnesota as well.
Mr. Bourne, at what age are you defining seniors in your report?
Madam Chair, that's always a really sensitive issue with people like me. Perhaps you. I sense
I want to see if I qualify yet.
we put that at age 65.
65, okay.
I'm having a little fun with you, but or myself perhaps, but 65. Our operating budget and any of these things, we're happy to come back and talk to you at whatever length and patience you have for this. Our operating budget for the current year is $828 million. We organize it in the ways that we're seeing here. The blue portion of the pie chart is the largest, the operating part of our budget. About 75% of that is transit and transportation. About 22% is the wastewater treatment operation, and the rest is community development and administration. Administration is about 1%. We make grants, and we make some loans, and our debt service are the remaining two portions of our operating budget. The operating budget is supported by a variety of user fees, state and federal grants, and other monies that that we impose. We have a relatively small property tax. Property tax is shown here, and the trend over the last dozen years or so, 10 years, shows the council's tax in red at the bottom compared to averages for other local units of government in the region. Our property tax this year is a little bit under $80 million and represents around 10% of our total operating budget. We use our property tax for debt service to pay bonds that we issue to finance a portion of our transit capital needs, and the rest are used for grant making and the operation of our a portion of our community development division. This is a little bit more detail about our property tax levy. Happy to answer other questions about that. You should be aware that the state law limits what our property tax levies can be from year to year in various ways, not that much different than how local governments' property tax levies are established. Big issues for us in the 2013 session. Every 10 years, and this is one of them, we are subject to redistricting. According to the 2010 census, we expect a bill coming forward to change the size of the districts for council members according to changes in population that have occurred. We have one of our advisory committees, and we have a number of them, has been sunsetted. We think that Water Supply Advisory Committee should continue one way or another. We'd prefer if the legislature reauthorized it, but if the legislature chooses not to do that, we would find a way to reconstitute that group. We think water supply is an increasingly important issue for the region, and this group has been important in the work that needs to be done. And finally, as many of you know, the governor has proposed a rather bold transit funding initiative, and no doubt you'll hear much more about that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, as Administrator Bourne indicated, a variety of functions performed in the Community Development Division at the Council. It's a staff of about 80 full-time equivalents. We implement the Land Planning Act, which requires that local comprehensive plans be consistent with the regional systems plans. We operate the largest Section 8 rent assistance program in the city, in the state of Minnesota. About 6,800 households are assisted in 95 cities. We implement the Livable Communities Act, which has three funding accounts. We've made over $260 million in grants over the past 16 years to 60 cities. leveraging over $5 billion in other kinds of investment, private and public. Regional parks planning and grants making. We conduct research to support the planning functions at the Metropolitan Council, which includes the growth forecasts and the annual population estimates. And finally, as Pat mentioned, we are responsible for the Regional Development Framework, which is the long, the 30-year long-term plan for the region, which we're calling Thrive MSP 2040. I indicated we have a staff of about 80. This year's operating budget of about $13.9 million, $2.6 million of which is pass-through monies to local governments from the $5 million HUD grant that we secured in 2010. Nearly a half of the division's funding is from the federal government, and almost all of that is to support the staffing for the rental assistance programs that we operate. Just over a third is funding from property taxes, and the balance is from state monies, as well as rental income that we receive on properties that we own and rent through our housing assistance programs. Quickly on the Land Planning Act, this is the 10-year planning cycle where we prepare the long-range plan. The communities then prepare their local comprehensive plans, which are due to the council the last day of the eighth year of each decade. We review them for consistency with the regional plans. This depicts kind of the cycle of that. We do the long-range plan, the big plan, then each of the functional areas prepares the system plans and issue the system statements to the local governments. They have 3 years to prepare their local plan consistent with that, and they write their plans, we review them, then the local governments implement those plans through their local land use controls.
Mr. Peterson, what did you say you're calling it, Thrive MSP?
Madam Chair, the regional A development framework plan this time is called Thrive MSP 2040.
What does MSP stand for?
Minneapolis-St. Paul.
I thought that. I mean, that's usually what it stands for, but it just seemed like a funny thing for the region to call it MSP.
Madam Chair, let me step in here. We know that some folks are sensitive about the council being too center city oriented, and we are sensitive to that and don't frankly want to throw off that impression. But the term MSP is being used by a variety of organizations to depict a region that's at least seven counties, if not 13. Greater MSP, for example, has used that in their name. And so we are using that MSP name to depict the region.
The region.
And we think the more frequently that's used, the more it's going to be regional in nature and not exclusively
the
two
metropolitan
cities.
Region, which is a big word.
We do, yes. We're all kind of searching for what the right name and brand ought to be. Our airport in airport circles, of course, is known as MSP, and it's located neither in Minneapolis nor St. Paul,
right.
And
it's in Bloomington.
Probably much to the chagrin of those two cities, but the so we feel that the MSP name is one that we could safely use and be regional in nature. But realize that not everybody agrees with that.
Okay. All right. Continue, Mr. Peterson. Thank you for that explanation.
I'm going to touch upon some of the individual areas then of our work. I mentioned the Metro HRA. The Metro HRA Act of 1974 set up and gave the council the ability to operate this Section 8 program that had been started at the federal level. We have the largest program in the state, 6,800 low-income households are assisted in 95 communities. Over 10,000 children have safe and decent housing through the vouchers that we provide, with folks paying 30 to 40% of their income for rents. Livable Communities Act, the three funding accounts. One is a polluted site cleanup account. One is a development account that helps communities with connected development, creating walkable communities using transit. And then we have the Local Housing Incentives Account program, which is to provide gap financing to assist with affordable housing. The slide shows the amounts that we've given in each of the grant categories. And some dollars that have been leveraged through each of those. And also we're beginning work and transit-oriented development, trying to figure out what our role is at the regional level in assisting transit-oriented development. We have begun to make grants that assist TOD through these all three of these grant accounts that I just named, and we hope to be able to make as much as $5 million available each year to assist transit-oriented development going forward. We have passed through a significant amount of money through the Community Development Division. About two-thirds of this is from the federal government. These is the payments to landlords for the rental assistance. Property taxes generate about 20% that we pass through to local governments in the form of these LCA grants, and about $9.9 million from the state of Minnesota to assist the local regional park entities that own and operate the regional parks. And the rest of it is from state government would be from some small state housing assistance programs that we also operate. In terms of parks, the 74 Metropolitan Parks Act set out a role for the council to do the long-range planning for the regional park system, with the local parks entities owning those parks and operating them. So we do the master planning, and we pass monies through from state government as well as monies that we generate through council bond issues to support the park system.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding this Metro Regional Parks, we just had a presentation on that in the Environment, Economic Development, and Ag Finance Committee. And the numbers that were talked about was that currently the metro area has 54% of the population and non-metro parks has 36. But in the future, we're going to be 52 and they're going to be 38. So my question to you is, it appears to me that the 7-county metro may be expanding out and some of that population may be considered to be non-metro regional park population. Are we going to address that in the future as the 7-county metro is expanding into the 11 or the 13 that we hear about? And how would that happen if we were to call the 7-county metro area a 13-county metro area?
Madam Chair, that would be I don't have an answer for how that would affect the regional park system. It would obviously affect more than just the regional park system if we were to view the region as more than the 7-county area. I do know there are questions with regard to the legacy funding, the legacy dollars to fund parks, and the balance that's trying to be struck between the metro parks and other regional parks and the DNR. But I'm sorry, I don't have a definitive answer for you on what the implications of viewing the region larger than the 7 counties, what implications it would have. So
I wonder if that's a question more for the chair of the Met Council, Ms. Haig, or even for us as how we define the Met Council,
exactly.
The metropolitan region. Did you have something you wanted to say, Administrator?
Madam Chair, members,
rather not.
I think that's a great question. I don't think you're going to see us coming to you with a proposal for expansion today. But it is something that we are asked frequently by others, just as you have today. And I think as time goes on and as population shifts take place and as development patterns change, I think that's a very legitimate question that you've asked. But we don't have any proposals today for you to consider. But if legislators, state leaders wish to give that some thought, we would certainly want to assist you in doing that, but as I say at the moment, we don't have something for you to consider.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, continuing then, this is a depiction then of where regional parks exist in the region. We have 55,000 acres of regional parks, over 300 miles of regional trails. We have 44 million visitors to our park system each year annually. So it is quite an attraction and is quite a gem that our region should be very, very proud of. And then my last slide, Madam Chair, is just a look at the six-year capital improvement program that we do that combines the state funding and our own council funding through bonding to pass dollars, make dollars available to the regional park agencies for preservation, improvement, and expansion of the park system. Want me to?
This is Lisa Thompson, and I'm the general manager with Environmental Services.
Ms. Thompson.
Environmental Services, these are our three primary functions, and they all originate from the Minnesota statutes. The region is blessed with three great rivers, 950 lakes, extensive wetlands, and a large 1,000-foot-deep aquifer system. And basically, our functions all support the protection of those water resources. One of our primary focuses is the operation of our wastewater treatment system. We own and operate seven facilities, and we basically provide those services to 90% of the seven-county metro population. In addition to those 106 communities that we serve, we also work with about 800 industrial clients. I want to point out that user fees pay 100% of the wastewater operations and debt service costs, and we are committed to meeting our mission of protecting the public health and environment at an affordable cost. Some of our more significant cost drivers include the ongoing repair and replacement of a $4 billion aging infrastructure system, meeting more stringent permit requirements, which call for higher levels of treatment, increased chemical and energy rates, as well as expanding the system when the region wants to grow. In terms of performance, our wastewater system has several outstanding achievements. I'll just make note of a couple of them. Permit compliance, our regulations meeting those, is one of our main focus areas, and six of our seven facilities have had continuous compliance records ranging from 6 years to 22 years. They are recognized for this environmental compliance by our own Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, as well as the National Association of Clean Water Agencies. Recently, we've been very focused on reducing energy as one way to reduce our costs. In the last 6 years, we've had a 15% reduction in our energy usage, which amounts to $2.5 million a year. We have our next goal of reducing that by 25% by 2015, and then 50% by 2020. In terms of how our rates compare and remaining affordable, this depicts peer agencies from across the nation. This was reported by the National Association of Clean Water Agencies, which does a financial survey of its members on a triennial basis. The most recent results were released in 2012. The costs reflect the average annual retail sewer charges per household for the reporting agencies that are in our peer group, which is organizations that treat 100 million gallons per day or more. So they're the larger wastewater facilities. We ranked fifth lowest of the 24 peer agencies, and we ranked fifth lowest in the previous survey. So we've maintained our standing, and we hope to keep it as good or better in the future. MCES's average retail rate is $216, and the peer average is $393, so we're well below even the average. For our surface water quality role, our impact is to make sure that the water leaving the region is as good as it was coming into the region. So we assess and report on the quality of the regional surface waters, which includes lakes, rivers, and streams, to try and identify the pollution problems, support regional planning efforts to meet state and regional regulations, and to ensure that our facilities with discharge to those receiving waters are not having an adverse impact on them. water supply, which is becoming more of an emerging concern for the region. As the region has grown, there's been a greater reliance on groundwater instead of surface water for drinking water supplies. That, along with the impact of development on groundwater recharge areas, has become an important factor for helping to direct our planning for the future. The Metropolitan Council's Water Supply Unit has been developing technical tools that will be invaluable in guiding those decisions to ensure that we have sustainable water supply for current and future generations. Focusing on our sources of revenue, 100% of our wastewater service is funded by the municipalities that pay the wastewater rates. That's split up between 79% goes to the communities, and then 13% comes from what we call sewer availability charges, which are new hookups to the system. And they're basically paying for the reserve capacity that was built in the system. And lastly, our industry specific, which we have about 800 industries that use our services.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the water supply planning role, and I think I asked this question last time we visited with some Metro Council people, and I was wondering, and I think they directed me to ask the question when you come before us. There's a water plan that's being prepared by your Water Quantity Supply Commission. I'm not sure the name of the commission, but I'm wondering when that plan would be presented to the legislature, or does it go first to you and then to us? I'm speaking because I'm near White Bear Lake and I have Turtle Lake, and and there's a question of how much we're drawing for drinking water and not being replenished. So is there a plan that they've been studying under the Metropolitan Council's auspices that would be coming to us?
Ms. Thompson?
Perhaps you're referring to there's an effort by the Lake Restoration Committee that's been tasked by the White Bear Lake Conservation District to look at a solution for the White Bear Lake issue.
Ms. Chair, actually, no, I was talking about the water quantity for the future. There's a commission, and I'm not sure the exact name of the commission, under the Met Council.
Water Supply Advisory.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bourne.
Senator Scalzi, I think you're referring to the Water Supply Planning Advisory Board.
Yes.
Which is one of those bodies that's due to expire. In fact, I think it has expired. We'd like for it to be reconstituted, but it will take a state law amendment to do that. That
Senator
work,
Scalzi,
frankly, is going on.
Maybe you want to introduce that bill.
We'd certainly be happy to talk to you about that. That group is overseeing the water supply planning work that we do, and that plan will be presented to that group, the council, and anyone else. We certainly do an active engagement with the public, and there are some publics that are really interested in this topic these days, the area that you represent, and others are among them. But that planning work is done as part of our as we're calling it, Thrive MSP 2040 work. So there'll be a portion of that overall 30-year plan that will be devoted to drinking water supply and the concerns that we have there. But that particular work is being overseen by this Water Supply Planning Advisory Committee. I'm probably not getting the name right, but we'd love for that group to continue, and it will continue one way or the other, because the members of it have been very actively engaged in mm-hmm. not just this work around White Bear Lake that's critical at this point, but others as well.
And lastly, we're part of an industry, of course, that's very capital intensive, so we have important focus to keep our costs low and to keep our services effective. We know that we have to pay close attention to our capital needs. So the goals of our capital program are threefold. First, to meet our commitments for regional growth and quality, preserve our existing infrastructure, and maintain a balance in our funding.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to Ms. Venowitz.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Amy Venowitz with the Metropolitan Council's Long Range Transportation Planning Unit. I'm here to give you a high-level, very general overview of our roles in transportation, since primarily this subject does fall under the Transportation Committee. The Council serves as what is known as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO, for the region. Our activities as the MPO are primarily guided by federal law and rules, though state statute does also require us to conduct long-range transportation planning. The primary functions of an MPO are noted on this slide. The major activity is to perform mandated federal and state planning activities for all modes of transportation, not just transit, also highways, bike and ped, freight, including preparing a long-range 20-year transportation policy plan for the region. The second major activity of an MPO is to allocate federal transportation funds that come to the region. In this region, we run a competitive process known as the regional solicitation, which typically allocates over $80 million every year, primarily to local entities for transportation projects. Federal law requires that funding decisions be made with the participation of local elected officials. We do this through the participation on our Transportation Advisory Board, or TAB. The TAB consists of city and county elected officials, state agency staff, and citizen members, and its membership is actually spelled out in state statute, too. Finally, one of the most important aspects of transportation planning is to ensure that we get public input into both the planning and decision-making for transportation that is taking place. And again, the council is responsible for this activity. In addition to serving as the MPO, the council also serves as the major transit operator within this region. The council has two transportation or transit operating units. We have Metro Transit, which you're all familiar with. Metro Transit does supply the bulk of the transit service within the region, both bus, regular route, the Hiawatha LRT, North Star Commuter Rail, and also rideshare services. Metropolitan Transportation Services, or MTS, is also within the council and is responsible for metro mobility, contracted private regular route services, transit link dial-a-ride, and our Metro Vanpool program. In addition, our region has suburban providers, otherwise known as opt-outs, that have opted out of the regular route transit system, and these providers provide service within 12 communities within the region.
Ms. Venowitz, would you just tell us briefly what the difference is between what you do, what the Regional Rail Authority does, and if MnDOT is involved here at all?
Madam Chair and members, regional rail authorities, every county within the state has the ability to constitute itself a little separate from the county board as a regional rail authority. Regional rail authorities do only rail corridor planning. One of their primary activities is to preserve rail right-of-way that the railroads have abandoned for future transportation uses. So the regional rail authorities are primarily involved in planning and then also right-of-way acquisition for future transitways.
Then who, just clarify for us, who is building the light rail, and then you will operate it? I see you operate the Hiawatha
rail. Yes. Madam Chair and members, under state statute, the governor is required for light rail to name a responsible government unit, and it can only be MnDOT or the Metropolitan Council.
Okay.
In the case of Hiawatha, that was actually MnDOT was the constructor. Mm-hmm. For Central Corridor, the council serves as the constructor, implementer, and eventual operator of the light rail. I think the assumption moving forward is that in most instances where rail line is completely located within the metropolitan area, that it would be the council.
Okay, thank you.
And then I think the other part of your question was MnDOT, and MnDOT is responsible for transit, not services, but they give out funding through contracts in greater Minnesota in the other 80 counties within the state. Transit currently in the region currently provides about 250,000 rides on an average weekday, about 94 million rides per year. Our services have an average fare recovery rate of about 28%, though this can vary significantly depending on the actual type of transit service. For example, Hiawatha LRT has a fare recovery rate of about 38%, and a service like Metro Mobility, which is a door-to-door individualized service, has a fare recovery rate of about 10%. In comparison to our peers, we rank in the top performers of nationally with the recovery rate of 28%. Transit can be a very important alternative, particularly to those going to work and school. Over 80% of our customers are going to work or school. We have 265 companies that participate in our MetroPass program and subsidize a portion of their employees' transit passes. We have been working with the University of Minnesota for a few years now on the UPass program, and a number of other colleges and universities have joined us with the College Pass program. And for about the past 2 years, we've been working with the City of Minneapolis School District on a high school pass program and are expected to provide over 1.2 million rides through this program this year. As I mentioned, with our fare recovery, we do have a very efficient and effective transit service. A 2011 legislative auditor report found that the Twin Cities uniquely performs well on both areas of efficiency, effectiveness, and impact. We're very proud of our regional transit system, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Okay, does anybody have any questions for anyone from the Met Council? Yes, Senator Peterson.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Testifier, legislative auditor report was done in what year?
I believe
it's been it was
2011.
Very early in 2011.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Bourne, could you give me just a little insight on how the redistricting process works and what the next steps are in that?
Mr. Bourne.
Madam Chair and Senator, the state law prescribes that in years ending in three, we happen to be in one right now, redistricting needs to take place. So we expect the governor will propose a redistricting plan to the legislature. We expect that you would take up a bill and consider a bill that provides for redistricting. It's important to know that the Metropolitan Council districts are also used in connection with certain other boards and commissions that are regional in nature. The Airport Commission, for example, takes our districts and uses them as well to create the geographic districts, not actually identical, but similar. Likewise, there are some state law created advisory boards for us, including the Transportation Advisory Board that Ms. Venowitz mentioned, also has certain district-like representatives on them. So the Metropolitan Council district boundaries are used for other purposes as well, and the bill that does the redistricting would also address those other districts as well.
Okay, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bourne, on the light rail, and maybe we're getting into the weeds here, people keep telling me that there's a large subsidy. By the cost somebody uses a light rail, what is the actual cost difference?
Should we ask Ms. Venowitz that?
Sure.
Madam Chair and members, I do have a book. I could get the exact number, but I believe the current rail subsidy is around $1 a ride. If you give me a second, I could actually look it up here.
You might compare that to...
If we go backwards...
Okay, that.
on that one. That system average is 28% for our fare recovery, mm-hmm. and as it notes there, the average subsidy per passenger across all services is almost $3, $2.94. So the service with the least amount of subsidy is our light rail service, which I think is a little bit above a dollar.
Hey, what is the
Mr. Senator Hall?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the greatest subsidy? What transportation use then,
Ms. Vanowitz?
Madam Chair, Senator, our greatest subsidy is probably Metro Mobility, though Transit Link Dial a Ride is very close. Those services are very different. They're individualized. You schedule an individual ride. You could be asked to share, but most frequently you're on the bus by yourself. Metro Mobility is actually a door-through-door service where they assist the passenger through the door. Transit Link, which is primarily in rural areas, the passenger does come out to the door, but it is a door-to-door service. And both of those have a subsidy exceeding $18 a ride.
Understandable. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you very much. If there's no more questions, then let's move on to we have a number of representatives from cities. Why can we bring you up as a team? You might want to grab another chair. League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and Minnesota Association of Small Cities.
$18. Wow. Of course, they have to have.
And so we're just looking for kind of a short overview of who you represent and some of your key issues. And we'll start with Ms. Nauman. I think she'd requested to go first.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. Legally, we're known as the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. We did a little bit of a rebranding a few years ago to shorten that name up a bit and try to avoid the use of AMM, which is just kind of becomes another acronym at the Capitol. So informally, we are known as Metro Cities. Our organization is a member-based organization that represents cities in the seven-county metropolitan region, and we serve as the representative of those communities, of cities in the metro. We have 86 member communities. That's about 90% of the region's population, and we represent cities at both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council, and I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. We are governed by a 19-member board of directors that is made up of elected and appointed city officials from across the seven-county metro region, and that board is balanced geographically and by city size. We have mailed to you recently a policy book that contains well over about 60 legislative policies, and those policies cover everything from revenues and taxes to transportation to housing to economic development, transportation, if I didn't say that, and transit, and all things related to the Met Council. And I want to just focus on that for a minute. You have a sheet in front of you, a handout that talks a little bit about who we are as an organization. Our goal really as an organization is to promote policies that benefit the region and its cities. We take a pretty much a regional, we sort of take the regional look at issues and support those that are good for the region as a whole. A general underpinning of our work, of course, is a strong state and local relationship that emphasizes good stewardship of resources and recognizes the appropriate roles of government. And certainly we are always on the lookout for maintaining local decision-making authority over those issues that we believe cities are better suited to meet the needs of their constituents. I wanted to briefly talk about our work at the Met Council. It was a key reason for the establishment of our organization nearly 40 years ago. We started off as a subsection of the League of Minnesota Cities and then gradually branched out to be a separate but still affiliated organization. And we were tasked with really kind of being the watchdog of the Met Council, and that's a key that's key work for our organization today. So I know that this committee has oversight of the Metropolitan Council, and we certainly want to work with you on those issues. But our policies cover everything from regional governance to the Livable Communities Program to things like density, affordable housing, water supply, transit, the whole works. over the last couple of years, we've had a task force that actually looked at regional governance, and we did come out with a recommendation that continues to support gubernatorial appointments of Metropolitan Council members with an enhanced process for assuring that local officials have adequate input into that process on the front end to make sure that the members of the Metropolitan Council are responsive to the needs of local governments. We did not come out with a policy that calls for having local officials on the council, which might come as a surprise from a local government organization. But I just want to point that out. I know that Metropolitan Council governance issues have been key for the legislature periodically are key for the legislature, so I want to do just emphasize that here today. But on the back of that sheet lists various legislative priorities for our organization. Again, those include many priorities related to the Met Council, as well as support for eliminating the sunset on the housing improvement area and special service district statutes that's listed there. I think that would probably come before your committee. But we certainly stand ready to work with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, Ms. Newman, could you tell me the differences between you and what makes you different than the rest of these groups?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, Metro Cities works. Our cities are cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. We do work really closely with the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Small Cities, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, but we really all have our respective focuses of work, and our focus is on looking out for the interests of metropolitan communities. So if there are issues that are before the legislature that are statewide in nature, but they might have metropolitan impact, whether that be transportation or local government aid or housing, any number of issues, but we really we take the regional approach. So our members are, when they come together to develop our policies, they're really kind of looking at what is of concern to cities in the region as a whole. And that, you know, the League, for example, I know Mr. Carlson will talk about their work, but they represent cities across the state. So they have different sorts of balances and focuses, and that's true with other groups. But, you know, it's really our area of focus and priority for our members. And we do have the distinct role of looking after the Metropolitan Council. That is a unique role for metro cities.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Nauman, how big is your budget, and who is it, all the communities, your 86 member communities that fund your organization?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, yes, we are a member-based organization, so membership in the organization is voluntary. There's no requirement to belong to the organization. We are, our budget is based on those dues, and that is really our singular source of revenue is member-based dues.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Nauman, how big is your budget?
Ms. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I believe our budget is around $500,000.
Okay. Who wants to go next? Okay. Ms. Sletten.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jill Sletten. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. Our association represents cities 5,000 and under in the state of Minnesota. And of those 855 cities in Minnesota, about 696 cities have a population of 5,000 or less. Our organization has a membership of about 291 members. We have a board of directors. We have 12 regents, and each of those regents is represented by a board member, and we have 4 at-large members. Our issues range from LGA, local government aid, to transportation issues, affordable housing, economic development, and issues that are unique to small cities. That's all I have. If you have any questions, be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Senator, Madam
yes.
Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would like to kind of get a sense of budget as well. I think that if we cover those two questions in terms of, you know, we need to get a size. I would like to get the same question to every group, Madam Chair. with respect to their budget and how sure. do we how do you receive your budget?
Sure. Our Madam Chair, Senator, our organization is a membership organization. Cities are not do not have to join unless they want to. They are based on population and a base fee. Our budget is very small. We have a budget of that, it depending on the membership of that particular year, memberships run year to year, but our budget runs between $120,000 to about $145,000.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, thank you. And?
Madam Chair, Bradley Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Bradley Peterson here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. The coalition represents approximately 84 communities across Greater Minnesota. What I like to say is it's everything from Grand Marais, which is about 1,400 people, all the way up to Rochester, which is about 106,000, and just about everything in between. I did attach in the material that we distributed a list of our member cities so you can kind of get a sense. We work primarily in the areas of local government aid and property taxes, economic development, annexation and land use, transportation, and environmental regulation, specifically with a Greater Minnesota focus. Ours, like the other two that have gone before me, are membership-driven, and our policies and strategies are set by a board of directors. Our current president is Mayor Bruce Algren from Cloquet. It alternates north and south, so next year it'll be somebody from the southern part of the state. And what I distributed here is a copy of a publication that we're putting out on a somewhat weekly basis, the Greater Minnesota Advocate, that you'll see in your offices. Here I list the issues that we work on and then also the staff of the coalition and the particular areas that they work on for your convenience. And so, Madam Chair, that's really all I've got from our perspective.
So is there overlap between your organization and the Association of Small Cities? So some cities belong to both, or would they choose between the two of you?
There are some cities that do belong to both, mm-hmm. Depending on the value that they see in both organizations and their historic relationships. So we do have some cities that are members of both, yes.
Okay. And Senator Torres Ray, did you want to ask your question?
Could you tell us about your budget?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray. Depending on the year, again, it fluctuates based on membership, but our budget from membership dues is generally on either side of $1 million, give or take, depending on the year.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bradley, you in your opening sentence here, it says, 85 cities located outside the Twin Cities. You mentioned 84 cities. I counted them up, and I see 82 cities. So,
well,
there's
Madam
three
Chair.
Different answers.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, we are still collecting dues for this year, and some cities are in and some are out, and so it fluctuates. I mean, when I started with the coalition in 2007, we had 69 cities.
All right, and last but not least, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I have some handouts. I didn't get them to the packet in time. I apologize. Members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I apologize. I'm losing my voice. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. The League of Minnesota Cities is a membership organization that includes 831 of the state's 853 cities. They can choose to participate in the league. We do a lot beyond providing lobbying services, and that's just one of the things I think that makes us a bit different. So when I give you my total budget figures, please realize that we do insurance services for our cities, we do loss control, we do conferences and educational training opportunities. So we do quite a bit beyond just the lobbying work that happens here at the state capitol. We also provide an investment option for cities called the 4M Fund, the Minnesota Money Market Management Account, that actually allows cities to invest their idle proceeds into a more higher yielding, I guess I should say, investment that does help make those tax dollars go a little bit further. As I indicated, we are a big insurance company. Back in the early 1980s, The cities in Minnesota realized that they were really rather uninsurable in the private marketplace, and they got together and formed the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust, which now provides property, casualty, and workers' comp insurance coverage for cities across the state of Minnesota. That's been a very successful joint powers entity for the cities in the state of Minnesota, and has really brought down a lot of our insurance-related costs through a number of loss control initiatives. So we also do conferences and training. We just got done with another one of our newly elected conferences. I know those of you who are newly elected here have been through a legislative newly elected conference. We do something similar at the local level for our local officials to apprise them of how they run a meeting, how they abide by the Minnesota Open Meeting Law, and other responsibilities of being a locally elected official. So that that process is ongoing. With that, our budget, the League of Minnesota Cities general fund budget as the league itself, is $8.4 million this year. And our insurance trust operation budget is about $10.2 million. That's solely to do the insurance operations for the state. We do not spend $8.4 million on lobbying, let me assure you of that. The lobbying part of the League of Minnesota Cities, when you take away all the other pieces, is probably about 10 to 14% of the overall budget of the league. The balance is used for those other functions, including the research and inquiry service, the conference and training services, and so forth. So that is our general fund budget. Madam Chair, I've given out a list of some of the items that we will be working on during the legislative session, and I'm not going to go through those in any great detail. But let me say that we will be in front of your committee on a lot of different chapters of Minnesota law. And I started to write down a list here. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 3, 43A, 118A, 134, 179A, 349, 353, 410, 412. It goes on and on. Some of those areas of law we will be offering changes to. Some of those we will be reacting to. I could have gone on to 429, 462, 469, 471. So we will be here working with you on any legislation that does impact local units of government. And our breadth, I think, is a little bit broader. We end up working on a lot of issues that otherwise don't get covered by the city organizations. Madam Chair, with that, I would stand for any questions.
Questions from members of the committee. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I was trying to. So could you tell me what is your total budget again?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray, the League of Minnesota Cities budget is $8.4 million per year. The League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust budget is right around $10.2 million per year. The Insurance Trust is basically an insurance company that provides property, casualty, and workers' comp insurance coverages for our cities.
Could you remind me? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Torres Ray.
We don't have in this handout kind of the legislative. Could you explain to me how the appropriation comes from to your organization, where the revenue comes from?
Mr. Carlson.
Specifically.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray, the membership monies come to us as dues from our members, voluntary dues into the League of Minnesota Cities. That plus we do a number of fee-for-service types of things, including our conference and training events. Those are designed basically to cover their costs. So those amounts are included in those total revenues as fees for service. The insurance trust also does generate money for the overall budget of the League of Minnesota Cities. But those are really the major sources. Membership dues is the largest source directly for the operations of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I don't have the exact breakdown of how much that is of the $8.4 million.
And since so many cities belong to the League of Cities, there must be overlap with some of the other organizations.
Madam Chair, members, the largest non-member city of the in Minnesota, I think, is less than 250 population. So virtually every city, there's only about 20 cities that are not members of the League of Cities. So there is a lot of overlap. I don't know if the Small Cities Association has a couple of those cities that are not members of the League. But I always like to say when a small city calls, whether they're a member or not, we're going to give them an answer. If they have a question on a legislative affair or a question on how to draft an ordinance, our attorneys will give them the advice.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to call up another team, and we're going to take down the PowerPoint during this. Invite two county associations, Association of Minnesota Counties, Mr. Berenson, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association, Mr. Carlson. Lots of names ending in sun. Oh, do you need the PowerPoint? Oh.
We had one that we'd emailed for the townships last week. I've got it on a jump drive.
Oh, okay. Then that's fine. You can leave it up. Just turn off the Met Council thing. Okay, Mr. Berenson.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I'm here today representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. The Association of Minnesota Counties, or AMC, is a voluntary statewide association representing all 87 counties in the state. AMC offers a wide range of services to its members that includes education, training, communications, and intergovernmental relations. Among other things, AMC represents counties in the legislative process and before state agencies. The 87 counties in Minnesota were originally organized to be administrative agencies of the state. Traditionally, counties performed state-mandated duties, which included assessment of property, record-keeping, maintenance of rural roads, administration of election and judicial functions, maintaining peace in rural areas, and relief for the poor. Today, counties have evolved into a general-purpose form of local government. Today, counties administer the state's property tax system, provide social services, corrections, child protection, library services, hospitals and rest homes, public health services, planning and zoning, economic development, parks and recreation, water quality, and solid waste management. I'd also note that counties also administer a larger road system than the state currently does. Health and Human Services activities make up the largest portion of county budgets. This is because in Minnesota, counties administer state and federally mandated health care and human services programs. Not every state is organized this way. In fact, in the wide majority of states, the state delivers those services directly. Minnesota counties are governed by an elected board of commissioners. County commissioners are elected by district, serve a four-year term, and are responsible for the operation of the county and delivery of services. Most county boards in the state have 5 members, while 6 large counties in the state have 7-member boards. For the past 10 years, county boards have been working to face 2 pretty significant challenges. One is a decline in state funding, which comes in several forms. If you think of the pie chart of county revenues, state funding in 2002 represented 35% of revenues. In 2010, that number was down to 24,000. Adjusting for inflation, counties have seen an annual decline in funding of $368 million over those 10 years. So one of the things that we've done as an association is help our members work together on what our organization has branded as redesign, and that's putting the focus on intergovernmental collaboration, shared services, finding better and smarter ways to work together. However, but I would add, because so much of a county's work is mandated through state and federal mandates, that those huge funding cuts obviously have resulted in significant property tax increases, despite the fact that if you adjust for inflation over the last 10 years, county spending has actually declined by 2.8%. County boards have also been working diligently to adapt to the new normal in our state, preparing for an increasingly aging and diverse population, growing public service needs, a changing workforce, and a shrinking base of taxpayers. Counties have a long history of working collaboratively. As I was mentioning before, AMC has been playing a crucial role in bringing those local government groups together. Multi-county arrangements exist for nearly every type of county program, from human services to public health to corrections to solid waste. These shared service delivery models occur throughout the state in metro, suburban, and rural counties. I'll also take an opportunity. I had 2 handouts in your packet. One of them has the Magic Act label on top. The Magic Act is our organization's and the state's 87 counties' top legislative priority this session. It will be becoming for this committee. The idea of the MAGIC Act is to allow counties in partnership with the state to develop and test alternative methods for delivering services aimed at improving outcomes and increasing efficiency. All 87 counties have passed resolutions in support of the MAGIC Act. And like I said, we will have that when the bill is officially introduced, we will have it before the committee, before you this session. At this point, I'll pause to take questions. Oh, and actually, to anticipate the question, I did send a quick email to our executive director. Our most recent budget was just under $1.9 million. And I'll pause for questions, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Carlson.
Any questions from anyone? Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. We're also a voluntary membership organization to which 13 of the state's larger and growing counties currently belong. We're governed by a board of directors that consists of two county commissioners from each of our 13 member counties. Our current budget is just shy of $500,000. Like several of the other organizations, we are not exclusively a lobbying organization. For the most recent year, less than a third of our budget was actually spent on lobbying services. We facilitate a number of staff committees in the areas of human services, public health, transportation, taxes and fiscal management, risk management, and human resources, and are the only entity in the state that provides those services for some county staff in those instances. We do have facilitated a number of joint RFPs on behalf of our members, including one relating to a new accounting standard relating to what are called post-employment benefits, and have hosted in some instances in conjunction with AMC's seminars on some contemporary issues, including the effects of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare on counties on both the human services and the human services side. I do just want to add a few other comments about what counties are. I passed out a handout of titled Who Are Counties and What We Do. I do want to emphasize one of our roles, as Mr. Berenson said, is to administer the welfare system on the state's behalf. We're only one of only nine states where that function is county rather than state administered, and we receive almost no compensation from the state for doing that. One of the important issues that we are facing this system is basically upgrading the systems that we are asked to use to administer that system. Right now we have four major computer systems in the area of cash assistance, child support enforcement, in the area of the child care assistance system, and in the area of child support. Three of those systems, for those of you who go back that far, are the old green screens computer systems that some of you might remember from the 1980s. They don't talk to each other, and we have to enter data multiple times, frequently for the same client, because of the archaic system that exists. Part of the governor's budget proposals is to update that system, but what we want to emphasize with the committee, and we'll be emphasizing with the human services committees, is that what's missing from that is the funding for staff to also facilitate the streamlining of the system that we feel feels critical to occur. As Mr. Berenson said, we are the provider of transportation services, both roads and highways as well as transit. You saw the presentation by the Met Council. Every one of the alternative transit systems that besides bus that was discussed there are basically major initiatives and receive major funding from the counties, whether you're talking about Hiawatha Light Rail, Central Corridor Light Rail, North Star Commuter Rail, the soon-to-come-online Cedar Avenue BRT. Those are all county initiatives and receive major funding both on the construction budgets as well as the operating budgets for those systems. do want to emphasize we also play a major role in criminal justice in unincorporated areas and many incorporated areas where either the city has not chose to have its own police force or is contracted by us. The initial investigation and apprehension is provided by county sheriffs. Frequently, we also provide forensic and we always provide medical examiner systems and any individual who's booked and jailed until such time as they are brought before a judge is held in county facilities. We also incarcerate those individuals who are sentenced to crimes that rate at the misdemeanor level. But the most important thing for you to know is those individuals who have committed and have been found guilty of more serious crimes called felonies frequently end up in our system. You'll note on one of the handouts that I've included, basically of the over 150,000 felons that are under some sort of sanction right now in Minnesota, most of those are being programmed, are being served by county employees, not by the state. The state of Minnesota has one of the lowest state prison imprisonment rates in the nation, and that's due in large part to the role that counties play in providing alternative services, frequently referred to as probation, to these individuals. That may also include jail time for those individuals. We also have substantial health care costs relating to those individuals. I'll just mention one of my charts points out that basically the funding that we've received for that has basically stayed flat for over 10 years, while all other aspects of the criminal justice system have seen major funding increases. Just a couple final comments. Very critical role that we play for all levels of local government is basically providing the infrastructure to administer anything having to do with properties. We maintain the property record system. We administer the property tax with no compensation from any other level of government except from the schools and the cities for administration of the truth and taxation process. We collect over $8 billion of revenue a year doing that and do it in a very efficient manner. Final thing I want to emphasize to give you the scope of what we do, we are the largest levier of the property tax in Minnesota, not school districts, not cities. Our levy is over half, again, as large at $2.7 billion. Versus the $1.9 billion that cities currently levy. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Very interesting. Questions from anyone? Yes. Senator
Thank you, Madam
Anderson.
Chair. Mr. Carlson, what area of your budget is probably your biggest area as far as and probably most labor intensive?
Mr. Carlson, the question is sure. About county budgets?
Correct.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator, Human Services is the largest cost driver for counties.
And Madam Chair?
Sorry, Anderson.
Mr. Carlson, what would you say? How much would that be?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have that figure off the top of my head, but I would be happy to pass that information on to you and the rest of the committee.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, Mr. Carlson. It looks like you're doing service here for no compensation, and that's quite remarkable. Thank you. Look forward to that information.
Mr. Anderson, is your question about the MICA counties, or is your question about all the counties?
Isn't that who
he represents the 12 counties in the metropolitan area.
About.
Is that what you're talking about? Okay. Just wanted to make sure you weren't looking at all counties. And then it should go to Mr. Berenson. All right. Thank you both very much. We have to reset up the computer for a PowerPoint presentation. Hopefully that will just take a few minutes and invite the township, Minnesota Association of Township people to come forward.
excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel of the Minnesota Association of Townships. And while we try to get the PowerPoint up and running, let me go ahead and just turn it over to Gary Peterson, our Executive Director, who's going to do the staff introductions.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for asking us in today. We appreciate that. I am Gary Peterson, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Townships. I took over that position last April for Dave Fricke, as you probably remember Dave in the past 35 years. To my left is Kent Sulem, our General Counsel and lead lobbyist here at the Capitol. And further to my left is Rob Vanasek, who also is a contracted lobbyist that works here for us. Jim Fisher, to my right, is a District 10 director for the Minnesota Association Township. He's also a township officer and the past president of our national association for 2 years in Washington.
Well, welcome, all of you.
Members, while we get caught up here on the PowerPoint, I think we've got it.
Yep. We got her.
All right, there you go.
The Minnesota Association of Townships.
Oh, Mr. Eric Peterson, sorry.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota Association of Townships, we are a nonprofit voluntary membership association. We have 1,782 of the 1,784 townships in the state as members. We have approximately 9,000 town officers that are members. We are broken into 13 districts. We did hand out a pamphlet for you to look at, and if you look at the back of that folder, it does show our district breakdown. One district director represents each district. They serve three-year terms and are elected to those seats. We have the myself, an executive director, 12 full-time employees. We also have one contracted employee along with Mr. Vanasek. Our office is located in St. Michael, Minnesota, and we do serve as the spokespersons for the statewide membership that we have. I'm going to, Madam Chair, turn it over to Kent Sulem, if that's okay, and he'll continue.
Okay, Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, MAP performs, like you've heard from the other associations, a number of functions. Primary among those is our training of local government officials. We train town officers. We also train a number of small city officials in a partnership arrangement. We're expanding that operation through a more formal program with the League of Cities. We do those through programs we call short courses in our business district meetings, annual conference, and special trainings that come up. We train about 4,000 officers in the spring and a couple thousand additional ones in the summer, and then the odds and ends. We provide informational publications and newspapers and our website. I believe all of you receive a copy of our newspaper. The most recent edition should be arriving very shortly. It went to press last week, so it should be in the mail if you haven't already seen it. If you haven't done so, please check out our website and, in particular, our information library. You'll find a lot of helpful information on that. We respond to thousands of inquiry services from our members every year. We offer an insurance, trust, and bond program. Our bond program is a prime example of how efficiency can exist in government. About 35 years ago, every township in the state paid a $250 fee for their clerk and treasurer to become bonded. They've never paid another dime to that premium. We provide the statutory mandated bond coverage for clerks and treasurers. If they were to have to seek that bond outside of our program, other states report that it's a couple thousand dollars per year. And we did it for a one-time $250 premium, so it's a very efficient program. We represent their town interests here at the legislature and before state agencies. A program you may not be aware of is that we do constituent services for you. So if you've got a township question, a constituent calls you with a township issue, you're free to call us, and we'll do our best to answer it. We may, because of conflict of interest rules, be a little limited in how far we can go. We can't be adversely representing our members. But we'll try to provide you the best guidance and general information as we can. We belong to a federal association called NATAT, the National Association of Towns and Townships. That's actually where we first worked with Mr. Vanasek. He was our lobbyist out in D.C. for a number of years before moving back to Minnesota. And as I stated, we do collaborative efforts with the league, the counties, the school boards, and other groups. We do all that on a budget of a little over $2 million, which includes the operational expense for the trust, not the claims and such for the trust, but the administrative business part of running the insurance trust. And about 37% of our budget is received through membership dues. The rest is a combination of registrations, investments, insurance fees, et cetera. So we try to keep it very lean and mean. Just very quickly, I want to highlight a few things about township government. We were the very first form of government in the state. You may have heard of congressional townships back with the Northwest Charter that created the state of Minnesota, creating 6x6 squares known as townships that then organized into actual government entities. You may hear towns and townships used interchangeably, and for all practical purposes, when we refer to them in Minnesota, they do mean the same thing. However, I do want to make this real strong differential, and that is unorganized territory. You may hear the term unorganized township from time to time. Please stop the person who uses that term and say, no, it's unorganized territory. We're working with the revisor's office to make that uniform in statute. But unorganized territory is controlled by the county. There is no town involved. There is no town government. We can't help you with unorganized township issues because that's a county matter. Town governments are governed by a board of supervisors. A traditional township has 3 supervisors. Some of the larger towns have gone to a 5 supervisor board. They are joined by a clerk and treasurer. Some towns have combined those positions. Most clerks and treasurers are elected. A few have gone to an appointed process. 2/3 of our towns still hold the traditional March elections, which are 3-year terms for the supervisors, 2-year terms for clerks and treasurers. About 1/3 have moved to November, and there you get 4-year terms. And a bill some of you may remember that this committee helped us get a couple years ago, an optional 6-year term for supervisors to allow better staggering so you don't get a supermajority every other election cycle. Township Day is the second Tuesday in March, so about a month from now, and that's where the annual meeting is held. Regardless of when elections are conducted, all townships do their annual meeting on that second Tuesday in March. There's a host of annual reports that are given. The voters authorize the town board to take various actions, or for that matter, may withhold authority to take actions. And most importantly, and most unique to townships, voters approve the levy. Townships do not receive local government aid, but the only form of state payments we receive are our gas tax funds through the dedicated highway user trust fund. We do not receive general local government aid. If you look at some of the historical patterns, our levies are, as I said, are controlled by the residents. However, the trend over the last 12 years has been that we started off in the year 2000 at 50% property tax dependent. As of last year's audited numbers, we're up to 73% property tax dependence, and we've been told to expect next year's numbers will probably look at 75 to 77% property tax dependent, a model we don't find sustainable, and so we will be working with all of you on trying to help with property tax relief and better ways of financing a form of government that the state auditor frequently has stated as one of, if not the most efficient form when you look at what we provide for as little as we charge. Common powers and expenditures of the township. Road and bridges is by far number one, taking up about 52% of township budgets. Fire and emergency services are close behind. Weed inspectors, people laugh at that, but that's a critical part of rural economy. Keeping the noxious weeds from overtaking the crops and choking out the agricultural economy of the state. And our members are very proud to serve in that role. However, we would like a little state funding that was eliminated several years ago to help provide training on that. Number of towns do their own planning and zoning. The rest do default to the county. And, of course, administering local ordinances and elections. Now, just very quickly, some of the issues that we'll be working on.
Just the local elections, not the bigger elections
We administer our own local elections. We do provide the polling places and election judges for state elections at for the local precincts. Mm-hmm. We coordinate that with the county and obviously all elections with the state Secretary of State's office. Mm-hmm. But we are responsible solely for our own March elections or any special elections that we'd have to hold, and then provide the local precincts for the state and federal elections.
Do your citizens have the options for mail-in ballots?
Currently, mail-in balloting is an option provided for townships outside the 7-county metro with 500 or fewer registered voters. There is a bill that we are supporting. We actually had it through the Senate, I believe unanimously, don't quote me on that. About 4 years ago, Senator Lurie carried it. And unfortunately, it died at 2 a.m. the last day of session on the House side due to other politics. And we are working with both the Senate and House to bring that bill back. As a matter of fact, it's being heard on the House side tomorrow morning to raise the threshold for both townships and small cities. Our priority issues are brought by our members. They pass resolutions at the local level, bring them through their county unit of townships. The townships in each county organize into a county unit. And then ultimately it's vetted through a process that ends up with a vote at our annual conference every November. Our primary objective is always to protect the town form of government. And an issue that many of you are familiar with, of course, that comes before the domain of this committee is annexation reform. We always like to keep that conversation alive and look for ways to try to improve relationships between cities and towns instead of fighting each other all the time. But we do believe that there needs to be continued efforts on that reform to restore the balance. We will be working on a comprehensive transportation finance bill this year. We view that as property tax relief. As I said, 52% of our budget statewide goes to roads and bridges. 56,000 miles of roads, 6,000 bridges, more miles of road than this the counties indicated they had more roads than the state. We have more than the counties and state combined. If you're driving in gravel, you're probably driving in one of ours, and we do our best to maintain them. We want to keep them safe. We're looking for some environmental policy flexibility regarding special permits and some wetland replacement ratios, more likely to start in the environment committees, but depending on how things are structured and what bills they end up in, may get referred here as well. Payment in lieu of taxes is also one of our top priorities, the PILT payments. As more and more land is acquired by the state through the legacy funds, through the Prairie Restoration Program, the DNR is starting, and through the wetland mitigation efforts, the governor has asked to be a priority. Most of that land isn't coming out of downtown Minneapolis. It's coming out of the rural townships. And so we're very concerned about having to keep providing the roads and the fire and the emergency service with less and less tax base. So we will be working to say the state needs to pay their share of the taxes to support the local services. Election law reform, we indicated one with the mail balloting. We have HAVA issues and recount threshold issues that our folks would like to see the recount threshold reduced to a 0.25% difference instead of the current 0.5% difference. And we are working in conjunction with our colleagues at the county, city, and school level on some general housekeeping matters of general concern. Open meeting law modernization is one that I hope maybe somebody here would be willing to help us author. We had it last year and just couldn't get enough traction rolling with the short deadlines that we had to work with. So we're bringing it back this year, but it's to recognize that when a local unit of government has officials participating in Twitter or Facebook or some kind of electronic media, not to conduct business, not to take votes, but to enhance public participation, to be able to have electronic communications with the public and seek input, that is a good thing, that we're enhancing participation, but it should not be viewed as a serial meeting. Right now, if you were to have two town supervisors, matter of fact, I'm pleased to announce that you can now follow our association on Twitter. As of 9 o'clock last night, we have a Twitter account. But if two of our supervisors were to post on Twitter simultaneously, that could conceivably be viewed as a serial meeting and a violation of the open meeting law. And we just think that's not what the open meeting law is about. And so we've got language, and if any of you would like to either volunteer to chief it or at least sign on to it, please see me. Be happy to get those jackets going. And the last bill that we're going to be looking, and I'll admit we're trying to get input here too, is we do have a problem with the number of animals running at large in the rural areas. People, unfortunately, let their dogs go for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's livestock. It's not always dogs. Sometimes the livestock get out. And right now, current law penalties make it very hard to do anything about that problem. And so we're trying to have dialogue and conversations about better ways to deal with animals roaming at large. With that, that's the very quick high-level overview of some of our priorities and what our members do and what we try to do on their behalf. And we'll stand for any questions.
Questions? Yes. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, do townships, correct me if I'm wrong, provide police protection or sewage systems or water systems for smaller townships?
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, we have two or three townships that still have their own police department. Obviously, that means that 99% are contracting with the sheriff. Now, that's done in a number of ways. Some just take the default. Number of townships have an arrangement with the county. They're paying for that extra deputy, but the administration stays at the county level. But the township pays for an extra deputy to provide heightened patrol within the township.
The same with sewer and water. Most do not have sewer and water because the density is not there. It's septic systems, although a number have created inspection programs or exploring inspection programs for the septics to keep them properly functioning. We do have some that do provide, for example, Fail Township up on the Iron Range has a very very detailed system of both sewer and water that they maintain. And, of course, White Bear Township, our largest, does a little bit of everything, including the city administration for two of the small cities outside of White Bear.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Yes, and I would just add that maybe that's why, you know, when you say you don't get local government aid and we hear so many things are being handled by the county, I think maybe that's why that balance is that way, because of the police protection and the other services. So just a comment.
All right. Questions? All right, thank you very much. We appreciate it. It was excellent. Just wanted to remind members that we're going to be hearing more bills. And if you have any bills that are being referred, remember to send a hearing request. And also, if you know that you have a bill that's going to be in another committee and re-refer to us, we'd appreciate knowing that just for planning purposes. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned.